This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. France is in a state of emergency. Russian bombers have joined French and American airstrikes on ISIS positions in Syria. Meanwhile, Britain's on high alert, with special forces being moved to London and new pressure to give the government more surveillance powers. All the while, a new vote on British airstrikes in Syria looms large. After the attacks in Paris, how should Europe respond to ISIS? Joining me in the studio this week for this special Politics Weekly is Guardian Middle East correspondent Martin Chulov, columnist Natalie Nougared, and security editor Ewan McCaskill. Welcome to all of you. Of course, as we know, on a normal Friday night, as people gather to drink, socialise, watch a football match or a rock band, terrorists claiming allegiance to the so-called Islamic State attacked and killed 129 Parisians and injured hundreds more. The attack comes in the same year as the deadly assault on Charlie Hebdo magazine and a Jewish supermarket in the French capital. So Natalie, let me start with you. Paris is again mourning the victims of an atrocity that's been called an act of war by President Hollande. What do you think happens now?
Well, Hugh, certainly we're going to see new legislation being passed through the parliament, introducing new security measures, possibly modifying parts of the constitution. And we will see ongoing security operations. It's very likely there are going to be more arrests. And if that new legislation passes, then maybe we will see pretty soon things like house arrests and other measures that had not been possible earlier. So the security debate is going to continue. And what we'll also see is there will soon be funeral scenes because the families and the friends are going to be mourning, and there will be those scenes, and those will be highly emotional. So we're still very much in the shock of the event.
Martin, what's going on? Until now, ISIS seemed focused on seizing and holding territory in Iraq and in Syria. There were threats to widen the conflict, but they were just seen as being just that, just threats. Why are we where we are?
Well, they've demonstrated that they have not only the capacity to do this, but the reach to do this as well. This is something that ISIS have aspired to do throughout the last 18 months of their self-declared caliphate. They've certainly been training large numbers of people. A conservative estimate is around 15 to 20,000 who have been through basic training programs in northern Syria and in Iraq, based on the old Al-Qaeda model from Afghanistan, but many hundreds more have gone on to do far more intensive, specialized training with the aim of taking their skills back to the countries from where they originated. That's indeed what has happened. They've shown a capacity to organize sophisticated, coordinated attacks such as this with real-time access back to strategic planners in Raqqa, and that is a shock to European security organizations, and it's something which ISIS itself has shown has reached a tipping point in terms of their evolution.
Was it a shock? Because they had been saying for some time this was an aspiration.
It absolutely was an aspiration, but there's a very big difference, as we all know, between aspiring to do something and having the capacity to do it. And what they achieved in Paris, as horrific as it was, required a high degree of coordination, and it was beyond the detection of some pretty powerful intelligence organizations in Western Europe.
Ewan, talk about those intelligence agencies in Europe, because so many citizens went to Syria, many of them will have been trained, they've come back to different European capitals, and so there is what many will see as a kind of collective threat. What are the security agencies doing? To what extent are they working together now?
Well, you have to have a lot of sympathy for the intelligence agencies. To put one person under surveillance for 24 hours requires 30 to 50 people. And they don't have those kind of resources because they're looking, in France, Britain, Germany, elsewhere. I mean, thousands of people have come back from Syria. So you have to prioritise who do you monitor. And they're really tough choices. And so I'm sympathetic towards them. Having said that, it looks as if in France, there were sort of major intelligence failures. The relationship in terms of intelligence between, say, Britain and the US is really strong. Five Eyes, Australia, Canada, New Zealand are part of that. But the coordination on the part of the intelligence agencies within the European Union are terrible. They're reluctant to pass over information from country to country because they think the other country, one of these countries, might be dodgy and leak it to someone else. So they need to sort that out. They've been talking about this for years, and that coordination still doesn't happen. And there were warnings from Iraq, there were warnings from Turkey of an impending attack. But again, you have to be sympathetic to the agencies. These warnings are coming in all the time. Yeah. Some of them are vague. Which ones do you take seriously? Afterwards, there's inquests and it looks obvious, but it's certainly not obvious at the time.
Natalie and Martin, there are two ways to go now, aren't there? There's a kind of keep calm and carry on way of proceeding, or there's the way that I suppose is exemplified by Tony Blair after the 2001, when he said that the rules of the game have changed, and implying that we change everything, all of the assumptions that we had, the values that we had. What do we do now, do you think, in that respect, Natalie?
Well, I think the keep calm part should certainly be upheld. I think it's very important because the people who carried out these attacks in Paris want us to, in a state of panic, want our societies in a state of division, tensions, want the whole of Europe, basically, not just France, not just Paris, but the whole of Europe, to reach that bubbling point where communities can't, you know, live next to each other. This is what they want to create. They want to create a virtual state of civil war in Europe, and that's what their ideology is about.
But does that mean you change
so
nothing?
So keep calm, but what you need to do, obviously, is intensify the efforts that we have been putting into trying to fight back this group. And that's in itself a highly complex question, but obviously we need to do more, obviously, you know, because of what's happened.
And Martin, what do you think the response so far has been to bomb France's massively stepped up its bombing operation? How effective will that be? What effect will that have on ISIS, do you think?
Not a lot strategically. It is an understandable emotional first instance reaction, but looking beyond that, militarily they will need to be defeated, but ideologically, how to take on this organization and how to remove communities who are under its tutelage from it, those who aren't necessarily rusted onto their ideology but are there because they have no other option, that will require a political process, and a political process that shows no real signs of getting underway. It will involve the major regional powers, well, it has to, inevitably, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, and the US, potentially others now, especially France and Britain. They will need to sit down and work out how do we bring a stop to something which, if we don't, the only option is mutually assured destruction. The Sunnis of the central part of the region are up in arms in many ways, not just those who have attached themselves to ISIS, but there are others, large numbers of others, who believe that the political process in the center of the region has completely broken down and is contributing to them being disempowered. So militarily, it will need a more sustained commitment, which doesn't just involve jets. That's a short-term thing. Beyond that, though, the broader endemic problems of the region seem to be so overwhelming that there does need to be a grand bargain to sort this out.
You want to tell me, how do you think the Europeans will cope, the way the future is likely to look for them, the security that they're likely to be in the future, and the changes that they're going to have to make? And what do you think the security services are likely to ask for against the backdrop of Friday's attacks?
Can you just pick up on Martin's point, first of all? At the end of this, you're going to need boots on the ground. Air campaign, bombing won't work on its own. But there's no obvious country prepared to put the boots on the ground yet. We don't know who's going to do it. Is it going to be the Kurds? Is it going to be Turkey? Is it going to be United Arab Emirates? Is it going to be the Iraqi army?
But that's the end game.
That's the end game. And we don't have an answer to that. And that's going to be an issue in Britain when we debate whether it should be bombing in Syria. To answer your question, people like myself and The Guardian have been arguing the privacy v security for the last few years. And it's harder to do against the backdrop of what happened in Paris. But we have to keep making that case. There's always the danger of privacy being completely overridden by security concerns. Now, as Natalie said, we see that happening in France. It's happening in the UK with the surveillance legislation. We've seen draconian legislation being introduced elsewhere in Europe. I would argue that that's the wrong response. But when you get events like Paris, then the governments take advantage of people's fears and
do change through. Nothing, though. I mean, is that old Keynesian quote, isn't there? When the facts change, I change my mind. Haven't the facts changed here?
I don't think the facts have changed. I mean, just in a purely intelligence, there isn't. This doesn't make. Some people say, "Well, this makes a case for mass surveillance." It doesn't. The people who were responsible, most of the people responsible for the attacks in Paris, were known to French intelligence. Yeah. So the argument is maybe you should spend more time, more resources tracking those individuals rather than pushing for legislation that's going to endorse mass surveillance.
Natalie, the other thing that happened in the last few days, of course, was the confirmation that the Russian passenger jet blown up, having left Egypt, was in itself a terrorist incident. Now, how will that change Vladimir Putin's thinking, and what will that mean for the wider European-led assault on ISIS?
That's a very good question. I'm just going to take 1 minute to go back to something that Ewan said, which I think is very... support that, the fact that nothing is, you know, some important facts have not changed. And one of the important facts is that, and I'm worried about seeing how some of the debates are developing in some European countries. After these Paris attacks, people are saying we have to close off our countries to the refugees flowing out. Just one comment on that. That's precisely what you don't want to do if you want to counter ISIS. Because if you let these people who are actually running away from two things, the onslaught of the Assad government forces and ISIS, if you leave them in a completely dramatic, desperate situation where they find security nowhere or no hope for life anywhere, you prepare the next generations down the road of ISIS or Islamic radicalization. Just want to make that statement. It's our collective interest to welcome these people and help them. On the Russia thing, it was fascinating that Putin suddenly switched gears, and the day after, a few days after the Paris attacks, suddenly recognized or acknowledged that the Russian plane over the Sinai had been bombed by ISIS. And that, I think, is because he was looking for some kind of political cover. He has to pay attention to his public opinion at home. Putin's foreign policy is very much about domestic politics in this strange authoritarian place that Russia has become. So it gives him the political cover to start working somehow in the same direction as some of the Western forces who've been targeting strikes in Syria. And what I mean by that is, up until now, he was essentially striking at forces that were fighting against Assad, and completely or mostly avoiding the ISIS targets. Yeah. Now he has that political cover to completely switch gear. I don't think François Hollande has been making huge concessions to Putin so far by saying he wants to open some form of dialogue and widen the coalition, including Russia. I think what we're seeing more. I think what we're mostly seeing is that Putin is trying to move towards a more sustainable position for himself.
Martin, might that be a game changer?
Well, Putin, for the first time in the last couple of months, can lay some sort of a claim to a moral high ground. And that's exactly what he's done, and Natalie's spot on with that. It still doesn't get us any closer to aligning vested and disparate interests on many levels. Lots of the stakeholders, if not most of them, in Iraq and Syria are there for different reasons. It's slowly edging towards an overarching, you know, ISIS is an enormous foe, but there is no broad recognition amongst all of those stakeholders that equally, if not more so, is Assad. and that if Assad was not there as a factor and the regime that he has run so ruthlessly as Syria has disintegrated, it would cease to be something which feeds directly into the ISIS ideology. So I think in terms of ISIS needing to be tackled unilaterally, we're almost there. In terms of the other incendiary factor in the region, we've got a long way to go.
If there's to be a combined assault, a combined effort, surely America will have to play a huge part in that. But Obama seems to have been almost a quiet man on this. Why is that?
Well, I mean, Obama was elected on the basis of ending the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, so he certainly doesn't want to be rushing into Syria or back into Iraq. But it's also Obama's position this week was quite nuanced, and it's something that I would applaud. He's basically saying, okay, there's all this people saying something has to be done. You rush in to do something, and then you look at the consequences afterwards. He said that's the mistake that the West keeps making. So he said, I mean, what kind of society do you want to emerge in Syria? What kind of society do you want to emerge in Iraq? So I think there's absolutely no appetite in America for putting boots in the ground, other than sort of special forces and increasing training of the Iraqi army. But I think America's quite sensible not to be engaged any more than it is at present.
One of the repercussions of this, of course, Natalie, might be a big fillip, if you like, for the Front National. How do you think that they will play it, and how will François Hollande try and deal with them?
Obviously, Marine Le Pen, just as after the Charlie Hebdo tragedy, although this is of a different magnitude, obviously, she will be looking towards ways of, you know, capitalizing on this tragedy. And there are regional elections in France. That's a cycle that will end mid-December. It's very close. And Marine Le Pen's party was already, before the Paris attacks, was given as a likely big winner in these elections. I fear that she has even higher chances now of pulling off a big victory and grabbing, controlling a few regions in France. And she will see that as a stepladder for the future. And Hollande, of course, is extremely worried about this. And that's why, in his speech to both chambers of parliament on Monday, he made such a strong sort of security pitch, you know, to the nation. It was the whole thrust of his speech was about security measures. That's understandable, but it had that domestic political dimension, which was all about trying to neutralize the ground for the Front National. And that's, you know, it's slightly worrying because it's triggered a whole debate within the French left about, are these socialist policies, you know, is security, can security be a socialist policy? You know, there's that kind of intellectual debate going on. But Hollande is now in fairly, you know, complex political waters now in France. And I do expect that although we haven't seen, you know, touch wood, we haven't seen the kind of the same amount of violence or insults labeled at Muslims that you could have heard after the Charlie Hebdo thing. We haven't seen that in recent days, and you know, obviously everybody's hoping that won't happen. But even in that context, I think some French people will be thinking, well, you know, this all goes to show we have a problem with those Muslims. And Marine Le Pen she doesn't even need to say it. She knows parts of the electorate will be thinking about it.
Looking at domestic politics, Martin, does it matter if we get involved in bombing in Syria, if Britain gets involved?
Britain certainly wants to take a stake in this, but has its own interest to do so, militarily on one level, politically on another. It doesn't want to sit on the sidelines while the rest of Europe gets busily engaged in a problem that is resonating not just in Europe itself, but also within British society. Does it matter if we bomb? I mean, the rubble's almost bouncing around in Raqqa at the moment. I mean, so many targets have been hit so often, the bombing would be quite symbolic, you know, sending the RAF to follow in the jet stream of the French Air Force isn't necessarily going to help. It would matter if Britain was prepared to take a more robust approach, move towards ensuring the safety of civilians in northern Syria, perhaps be a little more meaningful in terms of what they're prepared to do with non-ideological arms of the Syrian opposition. For now, though, it's symbolism, it's more political than military, and it's for domestic consumption.
Ewan, do the security services here have almost a foreboding about that bombing and what would follow here?
Well, Britain's been on the danger level has been severe for the last year. And severe in intelligence terms means an attack in Britain is, quote, highly likely.
Is that the highest level they have?
No, it's not the highest. I think it's the one just below that.
Okay.
Now, I mean, Britain's had a pretty good record since the London attack, apart from the Lee Rigby. And as a result of the London bombing, they moved a lot of people out of London and started to put them into, you know, big Muslim communities in the north of England and also in Scotland. Lots of informers, they're sort of well intertwined with the local communities. They're also very good at keeping tabs on people coming back from Syria, so they've got a pretty good record. But as with any intelligence agency, you can't stop everyone. You know, it's tough for them. And there may be people who've not been to Syria. I mean, a lot of the plots we've seen over the last couple of years have not been people who've been to Syria, but people who've been watching the Islamic State on social media.
Do they feel they have clarity from their masters? Because, of course, we had the incident this week in which Jeremy Corbyn talked about whether or not he would allow a shoot-to-kill policy, and it seemed very confused. Are the people whose job it is to keep us safe, are they confused?
Well, I mean, I think Jeremy Corbyn seemed to confuse shoot-to-kill in Northern Ireland, which was controversial, and, you know, I mean, now you look back on the shoot-to-kill policy in Northern Ireland and say that it was illegal and in terms of human and civil rights was wrong. But that's different from what happened in Paris, where you're asking police confronted with gunmen and people with suicide vests, of course they're going to shoot. That's a different kind of shoot to kill from what I think Jeremy Corbyn had in mind.
Well, finally, Natalie, Paris, how do you think it will cope with this? How resilient do you think it will be? It's a real challenge of any city to be asked to cope with something like this.
Yeah, people are how to explain? People are wounded, deeply wounded by what happened and deeply pained by what happened. But I came back this morning from Paris and spent the week there, and there's a real dignity. You know, you go to the places where the attacks happened. People are still way until the night, into the night last night. People were still coming and writing little notes and laying flowers, and people go there, and people are out on the terraces even late at night in a sort of, you know, calmly defiant mode. Je suis en terrasse is one of the popular slogans right now. I'm sitting at a terrace. You know, it's like life goes on. So I'm confident that Paris will and the diversity of Paris will be upheld and will be celebrated as it needs to be. But Paris isn't the only, you know, this was huge, but Paris isn't the only European capital that's been struck by violent, you know, jihadi terrorism. Madrid, London, and my thought and my message would be that we need to look at this as a European question that we need to address with the most solid, the highest possible degree of solidarity. And everything we do, whether it's the security angle, whether it's the military aspect of things, whether it's the social questions and the issues of tolerance that need to be addressed, I think we need to think about this together. Because if we continue, which we've been doing a lot on so many other issues, if we continue to think within our national silos, we're going to be more and more vulnerable to this. Our only hope is really to come together. That's I think something that is in people's minds in Paris as well.
Okay, well, Natalie, thank you for that. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Natalie McGregor, Ewan McCaskill, and Martin Chulov. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thank you for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.